Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone. This is issue number 60. It's yet another monumental achievement that we've been doing this for more than two or three issues. Yeah, it's amazing. But this time we're back after, well, we gone 1 week or 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
Yeah, two-week break. So, yeah, we're back maybe a little bit rusty, but hey, we're always rusty. But what we're going to do tonight is we have on Mr. Robin Laws. Say hello, Robin.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good, good, good. And like always, I have my much better half, Ethan, with me. Say hello, Ethan.
Hello, I am here. In Chicago, but I am here.
Yeah, you got to love Skype, kind of, maybe. But yeah. Why don't you explain who Robin is, Ethan, and maybe if Robin disagrees, he can correct you.
All right. Well, Robin Laws is a game designer, author of novels, comic books, and, you know, of course, role-playing games, who I have been familiar with ever since I was introduced to his awesome role-playing game back in 1990. I want to say it was 96. In Feng Shui from the time Daedalus Games. And ever since then, Robin, of course, has gone on to do numerous other projects and garner numerous achievements in both role-playing and other mediums. And I was sort of kicking myself when I realized I hadn't asked him to be on the show. So this is, of course, the second time we've tried to get him on the show because of wonderful scheduling and snafus. And here we are.
That's great. And
well,
yeah,
I'm glad the curse has left me.
I am too. Just don't say anything about nuking the Na'vi, because that'll destroy our computers.
Apparently, that destroys the internet.
Yeah.
Discovered.
Yeah. But yeah, I was telling Robin off air that, you know, I am I'm a retired gamer due to, you know, drama from other gamers, but I do have nothing but warm, fond memories of Feng Shui. It's a lot of fun, and if you haven't checked it out, you definitely should. But yeah, it just takes action movies and sticks it in a role-playing game. I mean, what can be cooler than that? But
exactly. So
we
what
asked,
kind of attention do you get as a retired gamer?
I don't think you get a tenure or anything.
I don't get a tenure. I don't get medical. I mean, I don't even get like 10% off at McDonald's. It's bullshit. But I do go sit on the park.
Like some pizza crust or something.
You'd think so. I do go sit on the park benches and feed pigeons, though. So, I mean, maybe that helps. But yeah, like always,
I guess I'll have to stick with it then if there's no... no decent retirement plan.
Yeah, there's no reason to quit.
Yeah.
There's no reason to quit.
Yeah, I guess there isn't. I mean, quitters always lose. But yeah, like always, we invited Robin on, and we're sticking with the format of how we do it before. Ethan and I do not choose the topic. It is chosen by our guest host. Robin chose heist films, which we will be discussing at full, as well as having our top six list of them. But before we do any of that, we have a segment we like to call Geekly Happenings. It's when we talk about news that's relevant to us geeks. Now, this is going to be kind of weird because Ethan hasn't had a lot of time to put it together, and I didn't realize that, or I would have been doing it, but...
That's all good.
What do you want to? Do you have anything you want to start off with? Because I do have some stuff off the top of my head I could go to.
Yeah, I'll start at the top of my list. I saw that Bruce Willis is currently being reported to be in negotiations to be in G.I. Joe 2. Production slated to begin later this month. The still officially untitled G.I. Joe sequel is still looking for a cast as part of the very first Joe, General Joe Colton. Following up on a previous rumor that Willis was to play the part, Hollywood Reporter says that he is in negotiations. So Bruce Willis might be joining the G.I. Joe movie, which would be it's always good to see Bruce Willis, you know, kicking ass, taking names.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't say acting, because he doesn't really do that, but he's got a hell of a screen presence. He's got a hell of a screen presence, and he's fun to – and, he's fun. I mean, I don't think I'd want to be his friend, but I like seeing him in movies, so that'll be pretty cool.
Cool. The other thing, off air, we were talking a bit about the Marvel movies coming out this summer, and Marvel Studios has, Walt Disney Pictures and Marvel Studios announced that they have scheduled two movies for the summer of 2014, but the studio did not reveal which titles that they can expect that summer. The first one scheduled for May 16th, which is 2 weeks after the Amazing Spider-Man 2 schedule, and the second one is targeted for June 27th, so... you know, of course, lots of speculation is flying as to what those movies could be, because that'll be obviously post Avengers. So
okay, that was, and you did say that was 2013.
2014.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's two summers from next summer. Huh.
Yes.
Oh, so that could be anything.
So we're now at the point where they tease placeholder announcements.
Oh, good God, yes.
There's a press release just to say,
yes,
we've got dibs on this date.
Yes, it's just so that they can get the internet buzzing about what might be the movie coming out. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah. I think it's Amazing Spider-Man isn't even out yet.
Yep.
And they've already got that on the schedule for 2014.
Yeah, so, that was actually a beautiful segue because I was going to bring that up as well. So Amazing Spider-Man 2 might be the biggest bomb of all time, Amazing Spider-Man might be the biggest bomb of all time, but by God, the sequel's in production. Well, pre-production. But yeah,
I think they should go with the musical version.
I think so too. I think that'd be awesome.
Did you guys see that?
I'm glad with the first one that they're remaking 2002 Spider-Man for a new generation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It has been so long.
Those 8-year olds don't know what Spider-Man is. I mean, really, they don't know his origin or anything.
Yeah.
At this.
There's apparently an alternate universe now of comic books, and I don't read comic books.
Yeah, that's been around for a while.
They killed off Spider-Man.
Are you talking about?
Spider-Man, yeah.
They killed him off, and there's some kid that's replacing him.
Yeah, Facebook was a buzz about that.
It looked very weird.
He's a half. I don't really want to comment on it because I haven't really looked too much into it. But I know he's not, you know, white. You know, he's not Apple.
Yeah, he's some
Apple
kind
Pie
of,
boy.
You know,
some people
urban black kid. That
something like
is
that
is out there to fight because Spider-Man got killed by the Green Goblin. I think they had him
probably
killed off by.
But you know, me, I if I were familiar with it, I wouldn't care at all. But since I'm not familiar with it and I have nothing invested in it, boy, I couldn't care less. But some people are really angry about it. I don't really see how it makes any difference. I wasn't mad when they made Nick Fury black. I don't see how this would be any different.
I just see it as another something else they're trying to do to sell the Ultimate series.
Just to spice it up.
I didn't know the Ultimates was still going on.
Yeah, apparently it still is.
I had no. I thought
Jeff Loeb was unable to destroy it.
Hmm. Well, he gave it his best. But, you know, man, we're all over these segues tonight. Speaking of white characters being turned black, did you see the casting announcement of Perry White in The Man of Steel?
I did, and it is none other than Morpheus himself, Lawrence Fishburne.
I like Lawrence Fishburne a lot. I mean, sometimes he's great, sometimes he sucks. There's no actor on the planet that isn't like that. But
sure.
I think it's a good cast. And Ethan and I have a friend named Anthony, and shout out to Anthony because he listens to the show now. But we were talking a little bit about it, and he has no hope whatsoever for the Man of Steel film, mostly because of Snyder. And I'm not quite where he's at. I have a little bit of hope, and that hope is entirely off of the cast. Because I like the cast in this movie quite a bit.
And speaking of Man of Steel, we got our first look at Henry Cavill as Superman. Did you see that picture?
I did. It was a good picture. I mean, it's just...
It looks better. He doesn't have Superman booties.
He doesn't have Superman booties. And I had the same reaction to it that I had with Bane, the Bane photo. It was a cool photo, and you know, it looks like Superman, and you know, Henry Cavill is, you know, he looks like he'll play Superman well, but you know, it's a picture. It's not the film itself. So I mean, so far, okay, cool. Now, are you aware of any of this stuff that we're talking about, Robin?
I did not follow the superhero movies with that degree of feverish anticipation. I figure that, you know, when the trailer drops, I'll take a look at it. But my attitude actually towards popcorn movies of all stripes is that so many of them are disappointing that I'm actually a real stickler for making sure that they get really great reviews before I'm going to leave the house and make an evening or day surrounding going to see this movie, because I'm a huge film fan in all sorts of ways, and so there are all kinds of other films competing for my attention, including foreign films or indie films or whatever.
Absolutely.
So to me, the really important thing is that it's a good movie, even if it's a property that I was invested in as a kid.
Absolutely.
If it's not a great film, I'm not going to go just to be mad at how bad they did Green Lantern or something.
Sure.
I want it to be a really good movie that's worth my time. So
and
to just...
And of course, the $12 you have to drop to actually see it nowadays.
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
$12, and then you end up.
Yeah,
and you end up, you know, burning a whole evening, and you wind up eating out, and so
yeah.
forth, and so on. So if I'm gonna, you know, devote a whole evening to something, I want it to be really satisfying. If it's just sort of interesting or so-so, or kind of have some good scenes in it, I'll wait until it comes out on premium cable or something. But you know, life is too short to see bad movies just because they stimulate a geeky impulse in you. And we would get better superhero movies and better geek culture movies if they weren't automatic sells, if people didn't go to them regardless of whether they thought they were going to be any good or not.
You bring up a really good point there, and I think that I know where I come from on this. There has been some superhero movies that have come out that have been very, very, very excellent. You know, like The Dark Knight, Batman Begins, etc. And I think the fact that I was treated to these excellent movies that are better than, you know, some Best Picture winners at the Oscars even, I think it's, you know, kind of whetted my appetite, and I do get disappointed time and time and time again. But I'm also able to make that disconnect and look at it like, you know, like you pointed out, a popcorn movie. Because, you know, like I saw Thor. I didn't think it was the worst movie I've ever seen. It was hardly the best movie I've ever seen, but I'm not pissed about it and don't really care too much about it. And I think that might be where a lot of people come from, is just that, you know, they're really hoping for something great, and unfortunately they usually don't get it.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, geeks are a really forgiving audience, right? That if you talk to people about, you know, pick a lousy genre film that almost everybody agrees is lousy, and if there's five or six fans hanging around this, yeah, but that one scene where the ship turns on its axis and there's this shot of it, well, that was worth it. That was good. And if that is your criteria, like if there's one good image that tweaks your deep geek tribe stimulation center, well, you know, that's why those films are no-brainers for the executives to greenlight, because they know that they're going to have a huge buffer of people who are going to show up, and even if it's a disappointment, we'll probably go to the sequel too. So like Green Lantern, which apparently cost a ton of money.
Yeah, $200 million budget.
And it did okay by summer blockbuster standards, but by no means blew the door off. They're still doing a sequel because they know that people will, well, at least they have a reasonable bet that people will show up. And,
and they're already at the point where the move, like in the case of Amazing Spider-Man, it's not even out yet, and they've already are writing, planning, and have a release date set for the sequel.
Yeah, it's nuts.
You know?
I mean, it's nuts, but you know, it's a hell of a gamble, and a lot of times these people lose an awful lot of money, and it sucks. But you know, when we're talking about, I don't remember the terminology you used, but you said something about the terms of beating your geek drum, about just being so happy that something's coming out regardless of the quality. What I do that about the most lately is the Dark Knight Rises. And there's been some cool Dark Knight Rises stuff come out since we've talked on the show last. Have you been seeing... Go ahead.
Yeah, the big thing, obviously, is Catwoman. The Catwoman photos came out.
Yeah. That's... and, you know... You know, I keep getting on that stupid soapbox about, you know, I don't like it when – I don't like people's reactions to stuff on the internet. And, man, I've seen nothing good said about the Catwoman costume, and I think it looks fine. I think it looks like Catwoman, if nothing else. I mean, you can't really fault it too much because, you know, it is a woman that's dressed up in leather like a cat. I mean, there's not
– And that woman is Anne Hathaway.
And
that's,
I love Anne
better,
Hathaway.
Really?
Where's Shay at?
Where's Shay at?
Anne Hathaway. He had
a... No, I'm the one that has a thing for Anne Hathaway.
Oh, yeah, a problem.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's also some unofficial stuff released, but, you know, there's no denying it. Like the full body shot of Bane. Did you see that?
I have not seen that, no.
It's pretty awesome. He doesn't look like a Mexican wrestler like he did in the comic books, and I'm not one to get pissed off because it doesn't look exactly like it does in the comic books.
Sure.
You can look it up if you want to, but basically it's he's wearing like military BDU pants, you know, like a tank top. He's got on this weird tactical looking vest thing, and he's got on like a big ass trench coat, and looks good. He looks big. So that's pretty cool. It was all, and that's the thing about it is they, For some dumbass reason, as much, you know, security is around this film, you know, they announced way ahead of time that they're filming in Pittsburgh, and there's people out there with, you know, high definition telescopic cameras that are getting these great pictures of stuff on the site, and or rather stuff from the movie that's probably not supposed to be released yet. But, you know, I mean, I'm cool with looking at a photo of Bane because, you know, I saw his head already and I saw the trailer and it looks pretty good. I like that. I don't know. There's another thing I could bring up, but it's like big time spoiler, and I don't know. I mean, do we want to like get into non-official spoiling with The Dark Knight Rises or what?
I'd say we should just avoid the whole spoiler thing myself.
Okay, why don't we avoid the non-official spoilers, because there's been some big stuff come up from those photos, and but I'll leave it alone, and I'm really looking forward to that movie. I think I've said that now for what, at least 25 shows running. So
yeah,
okay. So what else we got news-wise?
Let's see. Sort of my last bit on superhero movies is they released some high quality images from the new, from the reboot, quote unquote, of Ghost Rider: Spirit of Vengeance, which looks the images in it look surprisingly like the last Ghost Rider movie.
I didn't see
this. There's that.
I didn't see that at all.
It's just Ghost Rider doing his thing, and then Nick Cage doing his thing. You know, hamming it up, doing his thing. The cool stuff I've seen recently is obviously Sam Raimi is working on the All Great and Powerful Oz is one of his next projects, and of course Bruce fucking Campbell has confirmed that he'll be playing a quote unquote pivotal role in Sam Raimi's Great and Powerful Oz Oz the Great and Powerful. Pardon. He said he was in. And that's pretty much all he said. Sam Raimi refuses to tell me what character I will play. Just know that the role is pivotal. I'm pretty sure he's going to be like the doorman or something to Oz, you know. But,
yeah,
you know,
that would be always great. Fun.
It's Bruce, and we love Bruce.
We love Bruce. He can.
Well, if it's a revolving door, that would make it pivotal.
Yeah, that would. Oh, hey.
There you
exactly.
go. You nailed it. You exactly. absolutely nailed it.
And the last bit I saw that was actually kind of interesting is Cosmos, the TV series Cosmos that was with Carl Sagan is coming back, but this time Seth MacFarlane is producing it. The new documentary series comes from MacFarlane along with Sagan's widow, writer producer Anne Druyan, and astrophysicist Steven Soter, and they've also nabbed astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, to host with the National Geographic Channel co-producing. So Cosmos is coming back.
I like that
show.
I hear
this time they're giving the universe a story arc and daddy issues.
Okay, cool.
Excellent.
And, of course, fart jokes because it's Seth MacFarlane. So
yeah.
That'll be cool.
Pop culture references to 80s cartoons and stuff like that.
And Robin and I are coming just coming out of Gen Con, and the sort of two big sort of movie-esque announcements or geek-esque announcements that came out of Gen Con was Margaret Weiss Productions, who do the Cortex system and have done the Serenity role-playing game, Leverage role-playing game, Smallville role-playing game, all this, has gained the license and will be doing the Marvel role-playing game from Marvel Comics.
Now, was that first game any good?
The first one was from TSR back in the 80s and 90s, and it was fantastic.
Well, I meant the other Margaret Weiss production games.
I have actually not had a chance to play any of them, so I could not say. I've heard great things about Cortex, and talked to a lot of people who love it and people who have written for it. So it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what they do with it, honestly. So,
yeah, I mean, she's a legend in her field.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the other and the last sort of bit of news that I got came out of this was right before Gen Con was Fantasy Flight Games, who is one of the leading producers of board games, card games, and some just top-notch stuff in the industry, announced that they have obtained a long-term license with Lucasfilm for Star Wars, and will be doing card games, miniatures games, and a new role-playing game for Star Wars. They will not be doing board games, however, because Hasbro still has the license for that. So that's actually kind of big news. They were demoing a miniatures game called X-Wing at Gen Con with which was a ship-to-ship combat game. And then they had the Star Wars Living Card Game, which is sort of like a collectible card game, only not. it's hard to explain, but they plan on putting out a lot of other stuff. They have a quote long-term license deal with Lucasfilm to do Star Wars, and I'm excited to see what they do with it. So
that would be cool.
Yeah, I figured if anyone's going to do Star Wars fantasy, if it's got to be Fantasy Flight, I'm all for it. So
yeah, that's pretty cool.
Well, Robin, do you have anything to say about the gaming news? Anything cool happening lately?
I think my big impression of the show is just how incredibly busy it's gotten, and certainly busy for us at the Pelgrim booth. We had my new role-playing game, Ashen Stars, there, and we're selling a lot of copies of it. And so I was basically either occupied there or doing seminars or doing signings of my novel over the Peso booth. And so as a result, my ability to know what else is going on in gaming has sort of shrunk as it's become busier and busier, and I think that's sort of a trend that a lot of people were talking about, is just that as gaming becomes bigger, your ability to have a handle on everything that's going on in it really kind of shrinks. And sort of a happy thing that we're all busier and doing well, and sort of a sad thing that it's not the little corner of the entertainment industry as much as it used to be, and that it's kind of growing up and is hard to get your arms around now.
That's too bad, really. Because it totally has its place. And
it's also a good thing because, if the number of people is growing, if, for example, we have, we can double the size of gaming essentially by achieving gender parity. And we want to make sure that, new generations come along, that it's not just the same gray beards every year and you see lots of people in their 20s or young kids coming with their parents. So overall, it's a really great thing. But even with really good news, there's always, things that you're going to be wistful about for the old days.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. I really had a great time at Gen Con, and I'm sort of with you on that. It was a very busy convention. They had a lot going on, and I was pretty much going nonstop for 4 days, and was both sad that it was over, but glad that it was over when the bell rang on Sunday. And it was definitely a fun experience, and I highly recommend that anyone who has not gone should go. So
with 30,000 people, that's out of control. There's no way you can experience everything.
Well, it's a pretty big convention hall, though. So
that's big.
But, we'll see.
And it's gotten bigger since you were there. You were there for Star Wars Celebration, was it 2?
Yeah, that was in 2002, so.
Yeah, and it's gotten a lot bigger.
So. Oh, really? So then,
they knocked down the RCA Dome a couple years back, and they expanded the convention center into that space.
Oh, well then, good God. It's probably it's gotten gigantic then. That's good to know. That's very good to know.
Who's got sirens?
Oh, and us. I don't know.
That would be me. I'm in Chicago. There are
sirens.
Gotcha. Well, before the world burns down, why don't we get moving on to our main topic discussion, where we're going to be talking about heist films and all of their glory. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Peering through the mire, catch a glimpse of the sun, bound together with wire. Another day has begun, an ever-growing, overflowing list of what'll make this day
And we are back. This time around, we're going to be continuing our genre discussion. And as always, we have invited our guests to choose our topic tonight. And Robin Laws chose to discuss heist films. And whenever we do this, I always ask people pretty much the same question. And that is, why did you choose heist films, and is this genre important to you?
This genre is very important to me, and one that I've been thinking about a lot because I've just had a novel release called The Whirlwind Gambit, part of the Pathfinder Tales line from Peizo. And this is both a fantasy novel set in the world of Galarian and a heist novel. And so consequently, I've had to really look at the structure of the heist genre, what people today assume is going to be in a heist story, and how it's acceptable to fool them, how it's not acceptable to fool them, and to really go in and take a really deep look at the structure, how they're set up, which enabled me to go back and review, in my mind at least, a lot of my favorite heist films from the sort of beginning of the genre in the 50s to today.
This is actually a genre that when I was looking at it, you know, I first heard about it, and I didn't, well, like, when I first heard about it, you know, from Ethan's, like, hey, we're going to be doing, you know, we're going to be doing the heist genre, you know, my initial reaction was, you know, okay, I wonder how that's going to be any different from back earlier in the season when we did Crime and Gangster, and it's a very, very, very different genre than that, and I was actually quite pleased at how much fun I had putting together this list. I just didn't realize... just, you know, how interesting of a genre this is. I mean, it's there's some pretty good movies on this list, and it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about them. I mean, did you enjoy?
Oh, yeah.
What do you say, Ethan?
Yeah, I was putting together this list, and I was sitting there, you know, coming up with the ones that I've seen, I remember, and sort of looking online at various ones, and then, you know, just now I sort of remember when, oh, I forgot to put that one on my list. I'm an idiot. And, you know, slap in the forehead. And, the heist films to me have always been sort of in the same vein as, I mean, in and of themselves, they are crime films, but they are a different kind of crime film, just like an adventure film is a different kind of action film. You have the heist movie is all about, you know, getting the goods and getting away with it for the most part. And I've always really enjoyed most of the heist films I've ever seen, especially if they're sort of not taking themselves too seriously, but still being very clever about it. And it's a different kind of crime in that you're not, you know, in someone's face waving a gun. It's, you have to be a bit subtle. You have to be clever. You have to be intelligent about the way you do things. And I think that's why I really enjoy heist films.
Yeah.
From that aspect.
One of the things that I like about it is the fact that what I found with about a lot of these films that are on my list is that, I mean, if it's done really well, if it's you know, written in the right way, and you have the correct kind of characters and the correct kind of story, it has you actually questioning whether or not the story you were told was true, because it seems like a lot of these heist films take place in a non-linear storytelling kind of way, and it's typically like the quote unquote smart person that's throwing out all of these ideas and what's going on and doing the adding the locomotion to the story, as it were. And I don't know, I find it interesting. I mean, it's a completely different genre than Crime and Gangster is what I was very, very surprised about.
Sure. There's a couple of big structural differences. One of them is that whereas the gangster film is usually about the rise and fall of one individual who has a gang of people around him, but they kind of tend to be disposable, and he walks over them on his way to the top and then suffers perhaps vengeance from them on the way down.
Sure.
Whereas the heist film is usually about assembling a team of people. Mm-hmm. So it's about comradeship. Now, sometimes the comradeship phrase, and that turns into betrayal at the end, or sometimes they maintain the unity of the group and therefore succeed. And part of that is because there's been sort of a shift over time in the default structure of a heist movie, and that had a lot to do with the production code in Hollywood, which also affected people's attitudes towards films around the world. And it used to be the case that you could not make a film about sympathetic criminals who won at the end. Crime had to be punished. And so that is one line of similarity between the gangster film and the heist film, is that the gangster had to be punished, experience a downfall at the end. And until fairly recently, the heist had to go wrong, and the heisters had to see the error of their ways. And you see that for example, the original Ocean's 11, the Sinatra one, which is not particularly great. But people think of that as a romp, and I think are surprised now to go back and see that, spoiler, at the end, they lose the loot, which is usually sort of a standard element up until about and that's right about the time in the 60s where the production code falls away. And then you get to today's heist movies where the audience is rooting for the criminals executing the heist, often because the person they're stealing from is much more unsympathetic than they are.
Right.
And you're happy to see them win at the end and disappointed if they don't.
So you're really talking about levels of villain at this point, is levels of the criminal. It's like you're really rooting for the lesser evil in a way. And I mean, there are obviously the ones with the heroes of the heart, or the villains of the heart of gold, that type of thing. But it's really within the last 30, 40 years what sort of I consider a quote unquote heist film has developed.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And it's something that this could very easily be one of the youngest genres we've ever discussed on this show, because like was pointed out, and probably pointed out better than I could ever do it, is, you know, yeah, this is a genre that completely changed with the fall of the production codes. And and actually, this is one of the rare cases where I actually think I prefer what we're getting now as opposed to what we used to get. I mean, that's very, very rare for me, because I almost always like the classic things better than the newer stuff coming out. But this might be one of the lists that I've made that has, you know, some of the newer movies on it. I don't know what the oldest film on my list is, but it's not that old for sure. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what we got going here. So why don't we say we get this thing rolling, Ethan? What is your number six favorite heist film?
My number six is definitely a guilty pleasure. It is one that sort of creeped up my list, and most people probably wouldn't consider it a great heist film or a great caper film, but it's definitely a great Muppet film. It's The Great Muppet Caper from 1981, directed by Jim Henson.
Never considered that, but you're absolutely right.
It's all about a heist in that one. It's obviously them about them foiling a heist ultimately, but it's all Muppet goodness and Muppet fun. And while I was arranging my list, it sort of fell in at number six, and I was like, oh, what the hell, I'll just leave it there and let it go. My number six, you know, is the Great Muppet Caper, and I was personally surprised that it was a 1981 film, but there you have it, 1981 Great Muppet Caper.
Yeah, good one. I haven't seen that, I'm lying. I saw that maybe 2 months ago, and it's don't know why I didn't consider it. I love the Muppets, and it's a fun addition to this list. So, yeah, it's your number six, huh? Cool. All right. Well, what do you say is your number six, Robin?
My number six is Big Deal on Madonna Street, a 1958 film made in Italy by a director named Mario Monicelli. It has Marcello Mastroianni and Vittorio Gassman in it, and it reflects the fact that, first of all, that the heist is an international genre, and if you're a fan of world cinema, there are a lot of titles to choose from there. And the other thing that's really notable about it is that it's a very Italian heist movie, which is to say it's about things going horribly and comically wrong. And very often, especially as we were saying in earlier heist movies, it's an illustration of why you shouldn't try to pull a heist. And without blowing too much, the punchline of exactly how they get their elaborate plan wrong at the end is hilarious. And it's been a couple of remakes, none of them very good. The most recent one was called Welcome to Mumford, and it had George Clooney in it, I think. Definitely check out The Big Deal on Madonna Street, which is available on Criterion.
Oh, is it really?
Yep.
I love me some Criterion. Yeah, this is not a film I've seen. It's a film I was aware of, because I did know that it's one of those ones that's been remade, and it's not something I've checked out, but you know, you just kicked up my interest by saying that it got the Criterion work over. I mean, that's always a big deal for me. I love Criterion discs. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's not one I'm particularly familiar with either. I'm familiar with the Mumford movie, and I actually had no idea it was a remake. Hey, there you go. It's one of the things I love about doing this show is these movies that I get to add to my Netflix queue. So yep. Hey, definitely.
That's I've seen some damn good shows because of, or movies because of these episodes. So it's kind of cool. It's very cool. On to my number six, I'm going to throw one out there that I just want to get out of the way because I admitted to Ethan it was on my list already, so I'm going to get it out of the way so we can have a little bit of suspense. It's a movie that, unfortunately, a lot of people don't like, and I don't understand why not. It's the 2004 Coen Brothers film, The Lady Killers.
That's my number two, actually. I love that movie.
I don't understand why more people don't...
We must have waffles forthwith.
We must have waffles. You know, first off, yeah, it's a Coen Brothers movie, so that gets a huge plus for me. But, you know, it's a pretty... structurally, it's a very typical heist film. In so much that, you know, a group of unlikely people comes together to pull off the great heist and blah, 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 blah. But I don't think that the Coen brothers could direct a Pepsi commercial conventionally. And, you know, that's where this film really, this one really hits me is because I don't think it's a particularly great heist film. I just think it's a really fun movie. I enjoy the comedy in it. I enjoy the characterization of the different characters in it. I've said many times that I think the breakout performance in that movie was J.K. Simmons as, I don't remember his name, but the pyrotechnics expert. It's a fun movie, yeah. And I actually didn't know anybody besides me liked it, and I just found out recently Ethan did, and I'm pleased to see that Robin can at least quote it. So that's cool. That's my number six. I like it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I also really like it as well. Often when the Coen Brothers movies, a lot of the time do not get positive response from critics, especially the more comedic ones. Even Big Lebowski at the time was panned.
Oh yeah.
And like Stanley Kubrick, it sometimes takes a while for people to come around on those movies because they are so stylized and so striking and so individual. And a lot of film critics, especially critics who write for major papers, don't like that because they know that, or they think anyway, I think that audiences are not prepared for something that's very distinctive and weird. But you will hear no complaints from me about the Coen Brothers' Lady Killers.
The Coen Brothers in general, I don't care what they direct. I'm gonna go see it. I mean, because, you know, they make movies that, you know, just don't really strike me as an interesting idea, and I go and see it, and I love it. And so, I mean, I love them, and I especially like this movie. I'm not going to throw it out right now, but this would be very high on my list of my favorite Coen Brothers films, actually. I mean, when people talk Coen Brothers, they talk Fargo and, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and stuff like that, which are great films. But I just think that The Lady Killers gets a bad rap, because I think it's a great film, so... That's my number six.
And the heist is a perfect genre. Sorry.
Go ahead.
The heist is a perfect genre for them because they are so fatalistic. And at least in the sort of the earlier first mode of the heist film that we were talking about, there is no more fatalistic genre than men coming together to accomplish a goal which is inherently doomed. And there's no goal which is more inherently doomed than a goal like Coen Brothers' character has.
Yeah, and well, in Lady Killers too, going back to what we were talking about as pre-code, is, you know, yes, technically they get away with it, but they don't get away with it because, you know, she ends up with the money, and, you know, it's done in this usual Coen Brothers fashion of sort of turning it on its ear. And in Lady Killers, you have this great ensemble cast, and they have their differences, and it's more of a sort of a realistic type of a crime movie in that the criminals don't trust each other, and there's this maneuvering trying to go on to one up each other and to get the money on their and get away with it. And in Lady Killers, you have the twist of this great. They have to stay in the basement of this old black lady that is very domineering, and uh, in in Lady Killers, it's just great to see that that great ensemble cast that that the Coen brothers can put together with you were talking J.K. Simmons.
Yeah.
And it was he's fantastic in it.
I thought he was great.
Yeah, it was sort of like Ocean's 11, but done by the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
in their own quirky way, and it worked, and it just worked so beautifully. And it was one of the ones. I was amazed to see it hit number 2 at my list because I was like, I really did like that movie. Wow.
Have either of you guys seen the remake? Or I'm sorry, you're about ready to talk about the remake, the original. That's a really good movie, too.
The original.
It's Alec Guinness and Peter Sellers, right?
And Herbert Lom as well. And in the original, they are destroyed by basic human decency and kindness because the little old lady is so sweet
that
they wind up destroying each other. Where in the Coen brothers, which of course is much... it's sort of twisted to be even more fatalistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're not destroyed by kindliness, and their old lady is neither little nor unassuming, but they're essentially destroyed by the vengeful hand of God himself.
Yeah,
sure.
And I do think that that the movie does kind of homage that in so much as which I don't remember which Wayans brother was in that. Was that Sean? Well, whichever the Wayan brother was that was in that, kind of the fact that when he was sent in to kill her and he couldn't do it because she reminded him of his mother and it hearkened him back to a more innocent time in his life. And you know, the Coen brothers are big on homaging stuff like that. Even if they don't overall make the feel of the movie the same, they're gonna homage the overall thing, which is like a scene in a movie. And I think it's cool.
Yeah, I think it was Marlon Wayans.
Yeah, that's probably right. That's probably right. But yeah, great. I enjoy that movie. It's my number 6.
Fresh off of his success in the Dungeons and Dragons movie, no doubt. So.
Yeah. Cool. So what's your number?
It was Marlon Wayans. Yeah.
Okay. Now what's your number 6, Ethan? 5.
Well, 5. My number 5 sort of embodies the reason I like heist films, because ultimately the heist films are not about what they're getting; it's about how they get it. And this movie is all about that. It's Ronin in 1998, directed by John Frankenheimer, where they go all out trying to get this case. It's sort of this Maltese Falcon type MacGuffin, that they're going for this case. And at the end, the lady asks what was in the case, and it does. And De Niro says, "Well, it doesn't matter." I don't remember. And it's more of a sort of a spy type of a movie. However, it's all about this heist going on, about this they're trying to get – it's sort of a series of heists going on and then ultimately going after this guy. But it's sort of really the reason it hit number 5 for me was because of what I love about heist movies is it's not about what you get, it's how you get it. And that sort of embodies it to me. So 1998 Ronin.
I haven't seen that since I think 98, and it didn't do it for me. And so I haven't really thought much about it, so I don't have much to comment on. I do know that John Frankenheimer made some good movies in his day.
It's got an excruciatingly boring commentary.
Yes, it does. I think we talked about that on our DVD commentary show. It was awful. But
never watch the commentary unless you want to fall asleep.
Cool. Excellent.
And the interesting thing about that is it's a great mix of genres as well, because it also works as a spy thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it has those huge chase elements.
Yeah,
as well.
Great car chase, and that the whole car chase thing is actually something that has been really shoehorned into heist films of late. Like The Italian Job had the big chase going on in it, and you have that sort of additional aspect to heist films lately. It's kind of an interesting addition.
Yeah, it is.
And then you get Fast Five, which I have not seen. And the heist genre is shoehorned into a car chase movie.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
I think
those weren't even movies I considered as heist films either. So
Yeah, I don't know that I would. Yeah, they never occurred to me, and they probably could be considered, but I've seen a couple of those, and they didn't do it for me. So, cool. So, what is your number 5, Robin?
I bumped this up a bit just in order to be able to talk about it because it's a cool choice that I think people will not have heard of. So if you want to track down a film which I know as Darkness in Tallinn, but was retitled for the U.S. DVD market, City Unplugged. This is a 1993 movie made by a Finnish director, Ilkka Jarva Laturi. It was written by an American screenwriter, and it's set in Estonia. Mm-hmm. And it's in black and white. And the basic premise of this is that the Russian mob is taking advantage of a moment when there's going to be this big handover of, I think, gold that's been involved in reparation for World War II, or possibly at the currency changeover. But at any rate, they make, in order to make the heist work, they have to bring in a this beleaguered guy who works at the power station in order to shut off the power throughout the city for X number of minutes during the heist in order to complete their plan. And uh-huh. the twist is that this guy, who's the main character, his wife is very, very pregnant, which is why he is desperate enough to cooperate with the heisters. And, of course, the fact that she's very, very pregnant and the fact that the power is going off may have something to do with each other as the plot goes on. But it's a super cool, really well-constructed heist film in a place in the world that you've probably never seen a film set in Estonia. And it's super entertaining, so I would advise you to check that out on DVD under the name City Unplugged.
Cool.
Now, that is one that I have seen, and I liked it quite a bit, actually. I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah, it's a very good movie.
No, no, it's not one I'm personally familiar with either, actually. So that is definitely one I definitely want to check out. Cool. It is available on DVD on Netflix. It's not on Instant Stream, sadly.
Right, right. And moving on with my list, it's another film that unfortunately is not available on Instant Stream, because I just checked today because I was looking over my list. I'm like, man, that'd be badass if I could watch that. It's the 2002 Steven Spielberg film Catch Me If You Can, obviously starring Tom Hanks, Leonardo DiCaprio, walking in an Oscar-nominated performance. Mm-hmm. I probably like this movie better than I should. I had a couple of reasons why I liked it as much as I did. Well, first off, it's directed by Spielberg, and he's always a good director. I mean, maybe he doesn't always knock him out of the park, but he does know how to do his job, and he can at least put together a linear movie that it's fun. It's also interesting in the fact that it's actually based off of something that really happened. It was the story of a con artist by the name of Frank Abingale Jr., and his interactions with a FBI agent that was played by Tom Hanks in the film. And it's just, I found it to be a lot of fun, and I also found it to be kind of refreshing because, you have to remember when that movie came out that Spielberg was fresh off of stuff like, like AI, and I think he just released Munich, and, a lot of these movies, some of them are good, some of them are bad, but, they all had a mm-hmm. very serious feeling to it, and it was really fun to see Steven Spielberg just get back and make a fun movie that wasn't trying to make some sort of political message. And overall, I thought it was well acted. I thought it was a nice looking movie, and I found it interesting. It's my number four.
I think. Yeah, I love Catch Me four. If You Can. It's Catch Me If You Can is actually a lot of fun. It didn't make my list just because I really don't consider it much of a heist movie. There's a lot of chasing going on. And I guess it could be considered it could be a lot of small sort of micro heist movies sort of chained together. But it is actually one of my absolute favorite DiCaprio movies that he's done. And,
oh, sure.
And that movie, it to me actually felt like it was sort of the style, and really, I know it kind of sounds strange, but the whole opening credit sequence sort of made it feel like a sort of a Pink Panther-esque
I completely agree with that
movie, so
completely,
and
that's obviously what they
were going for, and they succeeded. It's a great movie.
I like it a lot. It's my number five, so I guess that moves us on. Well, did you have anything to say about it, Robin?
Just that I think that I would personally put that in the grifters subgenre of films like House of Games and The Sting, but I did enjoy that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to change anything and make some sort of social commentary, but I thought it was fun and I enjoyed watching it. So I threw it on I threw it on this list because I think overall I find this genre to be just a lot of fun. And, you know, that's really going to be apparent throughout my list because there's a lot of awfully fun movies on here that maybe aren't the most serious in tone, but I enjoy them quite a bit. But, yeah, Catch Me If You Can is my number five, which brings Ethan on to his number four.
My number four is a movie that I know you've seen, Aaron. It's a good one. It's although the heist in it is sort of secondary to the character of the film and the interactions therein, as is the case with this filmmaker, it's Heat, the 1995 Heat by Michael Mann, directed by Michael Mann.
It's a great movie.
There isn't one overarching heist that sort of prevails through the movie. I mean, there's one at the beginning, and then there's another one that they're planning during the film. But it sort of takes another step back from the sort of lighthearted heist movies and makes it a bit more gritty, a bit more realistic, in that you have these criminals that are interacting with each other and the police officers trying to catch them. Whereas in this one, you're not so rooting for the criminals. You're sympathetic to some of them. You know, you still want the police to win in this one. And in Michael Mann, in true dynamic fashion that Michael Mann can do, is he just creates this really great story between this team of robbers and this police officer trying to catch him, and sort of turns that into it's just a great character piece, and that's Heat 95.
And you nailed it. I actually picked that as my number 10. I put it so high on my or low on my list because of the fact. Well, for a couple of reasons. Mainly because it came up on my crime and gangster films, but also because I do see it more as you nailed it, a character piece. And you know, absolutely, it does have a heist going on and all that. So I'm going to include it in my list, but. Overall, I love that movie, but for me, I'm not that interested in the heist. I'm more interested in the people and what's going on there.
Right.
Now, is that one you've seen, Robin?
Yes, absolutely. And although I wasn't thinking of it as a heist movie, there's certainly that huge bank robbery action set piece, which, of course, was based on a real event. And I think you really have to admire the restraint of that film, which is all about arranging the confrontation of these two great American actors who had never worked together before, and they're in one scene. That's it. That's all you get.
Yeah, but I remember when that came out. That was a big deal. It's like, oh, but they only have this one scene together, and or actually, I think it's either one or just two scenes. There's the one scene at the very end. I guess that scene sort of leads into the other one, but and it's been too long since I've seen that movie. But
actually, it's one that I'm trying to see again because I haven't seen it in. Well, actually, I just saw it about 3 months ago, but I want to see it again because I love Michael Mann. He's one of my favorite directors, and this is one of his best films he ever made. But yeah, I love that movie.
Cool,
I absolutely love that movie. I guess that brings us to Robin's number four.
Yep. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Well, we were talking about fatalism in the heist movie, and there's no filmmaker probably in the history of cinema who is more deeply fatalistic about the human condition than Stanley Kubrick. So naturally, his 1956 film, The Killing,
has to appear
on any list. This features Sterling Hayden as the classic ex-con who plans to make the big score that will get him out of trouble. In this case, he's planning to steal money from a racetrack, and it just has some and of course it all goes terribly wrong. Elisha Cook Jr., classic character actor who people will remember from the Maltese Falcon, among other films. There's a really super memorable searing scene in which he, playing the usual poor schmuck he always plays, meets his comeuppance. And really, this is the classic the heist goes wrong movie with the classic final heist goes wrong scene.
Nice. And I've actually never seen it. Not a huge Kubrick fan.
Oh, that's right. You're not, are you?
But this could be one of those few Kubrick ones that I could probably tolerate. So
now take this with a grain of salt because I am talking about Stanley Kubrick, but it is one of his more restrained efforts, I would say. And don't take that to mean that it's Sunshine and Daisies or anything like that, because it isn't. But I mean, it's nothing nearly as crazy as like, you know 2001 or Clockwork Orange or anything like that.
Sure, it's an early film, so it's much more in the prevailing style of 50s film noir than it is super distinctively a Kubrick film. So it has that sort of pervasive.
So it's a bit
already there, but you don't have like the compositions where mankind is dwarfed in these gigantic long.
So it's Kubrick. It's Kubrick, but not it's a Kubrick film, but it's not a Stanley Kubrick film. Okay.
He has
just hasn't quite gotten to the level of being as super stylized as he became.
Yeah, he hadn't gotten to the point at that point where he was Stanley Kubrick, and he was just given free reign to do whatever he wanted to. I mean, he had studio notes he had to go over and stuff like that, and it makes for a good film. I enjoy it quite a bit. So yeah, that's a good one. That's I don't know why I didn't think about it, but yeah, it's a good one.
Cool.
So I guess that puts me onto my number four.
Your number four.
Yeah, and let's talk about some guilty pleasure movies. And I'm actually feeling kind of guilty that I have this as high on my list as it is, because it's not a great movie by any stretch of the imaginations. It's just a film that I enjoy a lot, and it is the 2001 Damien Lichtenstein 3,000 Miles to Graceland. I know. Go ahead, Ethan.
It's my number seven. Oh, is it? I love that movie.
I love that movie, and it's not that great.
it's not a great movie, but it is fun movie.
I watched it today because I hadn't seen it in a while, and it actually had come up on Watch It Now at Netflix. I'm all, hell yeah. So I checked it out, and I didn't forget about it, but the actual scene when the robbery is going down, when they were all running around in their Elvis costumes, and they have their, their big-ass machine guns, and they were intercut with the Elvis singing, What a Night and all that stuff. I thought that was actually a really interesting visual scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it still has one of my favorite movie quotes of all time. He rips off the filter of the cigar and says, filters are for pussies and guys my age, and the kid throws up, and it has a nice little cautionary tale in there. One of the only things I've ever seen Courtney Cox in that I liked. It's also one of my favorite Kevin Costner performances. I mean, he played a really good bad guy there. It's got Kurt fucking Russell, once again reprising his role as Elvis. It actually has a hell of a cast in it, and I don't know if I realized it before today, but there's a lot of people in that movie that I'm familiar with, and it's fun. It's not earth shattering, but I enjoy it so much. It's just a fun to watch movie.
Yeah, that's why I didn't make it into my top six. It's one of those guilty pleasure type movies.
Absolutely.
For me. It's one of those though that the heist itself is sort of secondary.
Absolutely secondary.
Where most heist movies, the heist takes place at the middle or at the end of the movie, and then then you deal with the aftermath. This movie is pretty much all aftermath. It's all the heist happens, and then it goes wrong. The criminals double cross each other, and then it's the chase after that of dealing with it. And that movie's a darn entertaining film.
Yeah, I know, but I just enjoy it probably more than it deserves, but I don't care. Have you ever seen it, Robin?
I have not seen that one.
Yeah,
it's pretty silly.
It's very silly.
It's entertaining.
I mean, it's just a pure cheeseball popcorn movie, and I watched it today with nothing but a smile on my face, and it's just one that I love for no good reason. So, yeah, that would be my number four, which brings us on to Ethan's number three.
Well, my number three has been mentioned at least tangentially, and it is a bit of a grifter movie, but it's The Sting from 1973, directed by George Roy Hill. And sort of the reason I sort of put it into a heist movie mentality is because, whereas most grifter films, at least the ones that I've seen, there's sort of this multiple grifts going on. This one has one overarching plot and one overarching goal and one overarching sort of heist that needs to go on. And it has this great, absolutely fantastic ensemble cast in it.
Oh, yeah.
Led by the incomparable, Paul Newman and Robert Redford together again in an absolutely fantastic movie. And this is the movie I was sort of kicking myself going, why didn't I have this in my list? I'm an idiot. And I put it in there.
That's a good one.
It's easily one of my favorite movies of all time. I mean, it's very, very much a fun and entertaining, lighthearted crime film. But it's more talking, and you easily at the beginning of the movie, throughout the whole movie, you're rooting for the quote unquote the bad guys. But it's
bad guys. But they're good. They're good bad guys, though. So
yeah, they're bad guys. You know, grifting a bad guy, and the heist in that is that they have to they're taking down Robert Shaw. You know, in another great performance.
Yeah.
I love the Sting. So yeah, my number three, the 1973 Sting.
I always like the music in that movie a lot. Good music.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I love it. It's a good movie. It's not on my list, but it very much is a good movie. You've seen it, right, Robin?
As a matter of fact, I guess I'm dating myself by saying this, but this was one of the very first grown-up movies that my dad took me to when I was in my early teens. So I remember it very fondly, and it had a huge impact on me because the sort of turn where everything goes horribly wrong in the middle for the Paul Newman character, which is the thing that, you know, prompts him to pivot and then, you know, win at the end, had a huge impact on me at the time because I, you know, hadn't seen a lot of films. And so that was it's a standard device, but I hadn't seen it before. So I took it really seriously. And of course, when they, you know, turn it around and it all works out, it's just, great classic 70s, Hollywood popular filmmaking at its best. I'm not sure if it deserved the zillion Oscars that it earned.
It won 7 Oscars.
Yep.
That year.
But it's certainly sort of a classic case of Hollywood entertainment. Just really well executed.
Oh yeah.
No, I really enjoy that movie. It's a good one. So cool. All
right, cool. Well, that was my number three.
Okay, I guess that moves us on to Robin's number three, right?
Well, as I think for historical reasons, for my number three, I'm picking Rafifi, the 1955 film by Jules Dassin, which I think, I could be wrong, is kind of the first classic heist movie as we know them, at least in terms of the way that it spends a huge long period of set piece in real time, showing the main action of the heist with all the safe cracking and everything and all the little procedural ups and downs as the main character overcomes all of these obstacles, these minute little obstacles involved in cracking the safe, that I think really sort of set the pattern for the whole genre. And if we're talking about it as a young genre, you can look at earlier films that are really more sort of grifter films like Trouble in Paradise from 1932. But really, this, I think, is the first full-on classic great heist movie. And this is, it's a French film. It was actually directed, and you would think that he's French from his name, but Jules Dassin is actually an American who had to flee the U.S. after the House Un-American Activities Committee went after him. And this is just one of the many great sort of noirish films that he made in Britain and later in France.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's another good movie. I haven't seen that in maybe 5 years, but that's a good one. I ran into that one when I was kind of like going through a blacklisted movies and or performers and or directors phase and ran into it. And it's a good one. I actually kind of forgot about it. I ought to check it out again. It's a pretty good movie. So I guess that brings me on to my number three now, right?
Yep.
Huh. Let's see. My number three, I believe this is when my list actually starts getting relatively, it's kind of serious. I picked for my number three the debut film of my favorite director working today. It's the 1992 Reservoir Dogs by Quentin Tarantino. I know that Quentin Tarantino's filmography probably consists of every film, and it is probably better than Reservoir Dogs, but I kind of like the whole working stiff idea of the criminals in this movie. And once again, you know, it's something we keep saying tonight, but you know, it's, you know, the heist is an after thought, you know, because, you know, what they're trying to figure out is, you know, what went wrong with this botched robbery where a whole bunch of people ended up getting killed, and that whether they have a rat or not, and kind of like where everybody's loyalties lie. And when it comes down to it, you're not, by the end of the movie, you're not really wondering, you know, what the hell is going to happen with the diamonds. You're wondering, you know, who the rat is. And once you find out who the rat is, you know what his fate's going to be. And I think it's a really fun movie. I enjoy it. I actually just rewatched it today, and I just really kind of enjoyed that feeling of the blue collar criminals that we had going on in that movie. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun.
Cool. It's not one of my favorites, but that's okay.
It doesn't have to be one of your favorites. Robin, have you seen it?
I have seen it, of course. I was actually at the film festival in, I think it was 90. Is that a 92 film?
It's an
anyway.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. The year that it was at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Yeah, 92.
You could just see the ripples of excitement that went through the entire festival due to this film were just palpable, and I think people could sense that this was a voice that was going to change cinema in the future, and it sure did.
It sure did.
There's still tons of Tarantino, you know, people who are not even doing Tarantino, but are only redoing Reservoir Dogs. Now, for me, there are other Tarantino films that I think are more meaningful, and that one is just purely an exercise in style. And because it is so brutal, I wanted it to mean something too. So I would, you know, look to other Tarantino films as my favorites. But
I might put it like dead last in my favorite Tarantino films, but I know what you're saying.
Yeah, but you can't certainly look at the history of the crime movie or movies with a bank robbery in them without seeing that as, you know, incredibly influential in terms of its style and its postmodern homage to all sorts of other films while being, you know, he has both a voice which is 100% derivative and because of that 100% unique, and that's certainly where that started.
Absolutely. I mean, and he's, we've done it before and I've said it many times, but he's the director right now that just excites me with everything that he makes, and I think he's a force to be reckoned with, and I enjoy all of his movies. And while this is my least favorite of his movies, and it is definitely not nearly as meaningful as some of his other films, it doesn't change the fact that I do like it quite a bit. So that's why I chose it for my number three. I guess that's going to be moving us on. Now, Ethan, you said your number two was The Lady Killers, right?
Yep, was Lady Killers, yes.
And did you have anything else to add, or did you think you got it covered?
I think I got it covered with that one.
Okay, well, I guess that just brings us right on over to Robin's number two.
Yeah, here's where I use my guest prerogative to wildly cheat, and I'm going to wrap the Steven Soderbergh Oceans movies into a trilogy and count them all as my number two choice. So Oceans 11 from 2001, 12 from 2004, and 13 from 2007. The first one, 11, is one of my most rewatchable movies. When I'm struck with a bout of insomnia, that and a few others are the ones that I pull out to sit down in front of, and just the pure style and joy of cinema in that, airtight construction of the heist plot, and of course the star charisma with this gigantic ensemble cast.
Yeah.
It really, for me, is the modern exponent of the heist genre. The second one, which I think a lot of people kind of disregarded, I think is super underrated. In that one, I think Soderbergh is trying to push as far as he possibly can into not really even caring so much about the plot as just sort of exploring the beauty of cinematic glamour and style. And there are moments in that, actually, reunion with Albert Finney, for example, that I just actually found extraordinarily moving just because of the way that they were shot and put together and the use of music. And I think that that is one of the greatest examples of making sort of high art out of something that seems to just be fluffy and even on the screenplay level, just sort of haphazardly slapped together. And the third one, I enjoy quite a bit. I think it's the least interesting of them all. It's more of a remake of the first one.
Right.
But again, it's just so well executed that you don't want to leave it off the list.
Yeah, but it's Ocean's 11 is actually number 9 on my list, and the other movies, I could easily roll them into that one as well. And I'm one of those that didn't really enjoy the second movie as much, but it really was this sort of ensemble, this cast that worked so well together. And the third movie is a bit more of a remake of the first one in a sense, but really it's an enjoyable movie to watch just based on character interaction and just to see, you know, the addition of Al Pacino into that mix and just to see where they go with it. And I sort of agree with you. It's a fun one.
I haven't seen the third one, and I did like the first one quite a bit, and I don't really have any particular negative feelings about the second one. I just didn't really move on to the third one. I don't really know why, but yeah, I mean, I love Soderbergh, and I love ensemble cast, and they're good movies. I would absolutely recommend. Those are a good safe bet for anybody listening to check out if they want a good night or even a couple of nights of easy movie watching to kind of get a feeling for modern heist films. This would be a good place to start, I think. They're really good movies. So
yeah, definitely, yeah.
Guess that's got to bring me onto my number 2, right?
Correct.
Oh, boy. Let's see. My number 2 is a film that we've talked about on this show before, not this specific issue, but we have talked about it on the show before. It's a new film. It's a 2010 Christopher Nolan film, Inception.
I knew this one would show up on your list somewhere.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not really feeling this list. I don't know how well I have the order worked out on it. I love Inception, and I think I liked it a lot better than Ethan did. I pick it because, you know, when it comes down to it, and I think it's reflective in, you know, the movies I've named off so far, and especially my honorable mentions, is that sure. I like the heist films. Fine, and don't take this as an insult to him, but I don't respect it so much because it's just so formulaic that it's so often not done well. I mean, I could easily make a top 10 list of heist films that I don't like, and really easily, probably easier than I could order this list. But I thought Inception made it interesting to me because, like, a lot of the times, you know, with some of these heist films that the way that they make them interesting, or at least to me, is they throw in different twists with the characters and, you know, whatnot. You know, they make, you know, the hooker with the heart of gold, or the mob boss hidden in the guise of a idiot or something like that. But, you know, with Inception, you take the heist film and you truly turn it on its ear by completely changing the way that you look at the way that the heist goes. I mean, whoever, or even, you know, the product of your heist, you know, what you're stealing, and in this case you're implanting an idea, which is even a stranger idea of looking at a heist, because they're not taking anything, they're leaving something. And, you know, once again, you know, Christopher Nolan, you know, is a very good ensemble cast director, and, you know, he hasn't done much better than he did with this film. I love the effects. You know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but they're excellent effects. It was a great screenplay. It was just an all-around, I thought it was a very pleasing movie. I really liked it, and I think it could It was an exciting heist movie, which is really refreshing to me because I'm just not particularly excited about heist films overall. So,
and I really couldn't agree more. It's actually my number one.
Yeah, how many shows have we done that now where my number two has been your number one?
I don't know.
It's seriously been like 3 or 4 in a row, but I'm sorry, continue.
No problem. I think as sort of liking specific heist films and whatnot, this one sort of stands out as a very unique heist movie to me. It has the, you know, putting together a team and needing to accomplish some sort of a goal, but obviously instead of breaking into a bank and stealing the money, it's you're breaking into someone's mind and implanting something, and in a way accomplishing your goal to get things done. And sort of all of the existential things aside about that movie, it is a very unique and fun heist movie in and of itself, in that it's you got this team of people and they're working together to do their job, and you sort of watch this movie and don't even really come to the realization that they're criminals, because it's such an interesting
and it's also not something we're familiar with. You know, we look at somebody who's, you know, robbing a bank or whatever, and, you know, we have that to, you know, real world relate to, and, you know, yeah, it's bad to rob a bank, but in this movie, you know, they're they're mental terrorists or whatever, and that really gets you to some really interesting places, you know, ethically. And yeah, you're right. You don't think of them as criminals, but they absolutely are, and they even state as much in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and really, you don't really pay that much attention to it, and because you're so enamored by the overall concept of the movie, and but it boiling it down, it is your basic heist movie, and it's executed flawlessly by Nolan, and a beautiful film. Yeah, so it's my number one. So there you go.
Cool. Now, have you seen it, Robin?
How often do you have a film that shows up on everybody's list?
That happens pretty often, but we rarely ever have the same number one.
Well, it's number 8 on my list, and I think aside from what you've said about it, I'd make two observations. One of them is that structurally it's very interesting in that it's a action movie and a heist movie as well, of course, without a villain. There's no bad guy. You sympathize with the guy who's sort of the target of what they're doing, and they're fighting a mental landscape, but they're not fighting any
but he himself is not evil, and you don't want him to go to go down in flames.
That's one of the more interesting things about that movie is you do walk away with a lot of sympathy for Cillian Murphy's character.
So, and the other thing that is I think really interesting about it is that it is an example of a trend which I think we first saw in role-playing games and we now see a lot in films. And it's a term that I, a phenomena I call nerd troping, and that's when you take a older genre that's traditionally just been a mundane genre without fantastical elements, and I mean fantastical in a really broad sense of all of the different crazy genres that appeal to geeks, and then you add fantastical elements to it to make it appeal to today's increasingly geeky mass audience. So in this case, you are taking the heist film and adding this whole layer of the science fiction mindfuck movie to it.
Right.
Or you know, there's that upcoming movie Real Steel, which tropes the boxing robots in it.
It's Rock'em Sock'em Robots the movie.
It is. Or, you know, but obviously you can tell just from the trailer that it follows all of the beats of traditional fight film, except the fighter's a robot. Or, you know, just a few weeks ago, Cowboys and Aliens. So, you know, we saw that a long time ago in role-playing games where, for example, Deadlands made the Western popular by adding magic and steampunk and all these other elements to it. And now, as geek culture becomes mainstream culture, we're seeing more and more nerd troping.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a fun turn it on its ear type of a film, and I like to see new and unique viewpoints on genres and how they take things and add something cool and interesting.
Yeah, so. I love that movie. It's one of the better movies I've seen in a couple of years. So yeah, that's why it's my number two. I guess it gets down to your favorite, Robin.
Are we skipping Ethan? Oh yes, we have
Ethan
because he's in Inception.
Yeah,
For my favorite, I'm going to return to the Criterion Collection into France in the 1950s for Bob le Flambeur by Jean-Pierre Melville. Melville is this great, fascinating filmmaker who sort of defined a Gallic version of noirish cool, and this has a not just spoil anything too much, but has a great little twist on the whole idea of the doomed heist and just how doomed you may or may not be. But it's just sort of its beautiful elegiac style and an atmosphere that makes that one of my favorite films of all time, and therefore my favorite heist film. That's about a gambler who gets inveigled into taking part in a plan to knock over a casino. There are other Melville films that are also heist films, Le Cercle Rouge, The Red Circle is one of them. But this is the one that for me really stands out as Melville's most Melvillian film and therefore my favorite heist movie.
It's awesome. That's one of those ones. The only reason I ran into it was because it was a Criterion. And you're right, it's awesome. It's so much. It's just one of those movies that you walk away from and, you know, you... It'll pop into my mind sometimes when I'm watching a bad movie and I'm thinking, good God, is this is this, you know, stupid Tyler Perry movie even considered the same breed of something as this film? Yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic movie, and I completely forgot about it, and damn, if I ought to make it my number one, but I'm not going to because that'd be cheating. But it's a fantastic movie. Fantastic movie.
And it was remade not so long ago by Neil Jordan, The Good Thief with Nick Nolte, which is a good film, worth seeing, right. But no patch on the original.
No, not even close. Far from it, I would say. But I guess we got to get to my number one, and we're going to get to... It's going to be kind of anticlimactic, because, honestly, I'm looking at my list, and I probably should have picked Inception as my number one, but, hey, we've already recorded it. But my number one is the 1995...
Well, we could go back in your dreams and change your memory.
Maybe we could.
Well, we could do that, yes.
Hell, we could just edit it. I mean, we're recording it and stuff, but I'm not going to do that, because I do like my number one a lot. I would probably say enjoy Inception more, but my number one is the 1995 Bryan Singer film The Usual Suspects. My thing about that movie is those of us old enough to remember when the movie came out, you know, they would remember that, you know, this was like a very, very big thing when this movie came out. I mean, it was, you know, Kevin Spacey won an Oscar for it, and you know, put Bryan Singer and Christopher McQuarrie and people like that on the fast track of, you know, these great careers. And it's one of those interesting movies that, you know, it's one of the first movies that comes to somebody in, you know, my age brackets mind when you talk about movies with the twist at the end. And one of the things that's interesting about it is it actually kind of has two twists at the end, you know, with the fake revelation of who Kaiser Soze is and how it turns out who it really is. So, you know, it kind of has you zigging and zagging there at the end. And I picked this as my number one. You know, I'm going back to what I said about about Inception, where, you know, I say that this actually kind of plays with the idea of what a heist film is. And, you know, most of your heist films, you know, you put together the team and they're going to go steal, you know, some sort of material, something. And in this case, you know, while you think that they're going to go in and they're stealing some money, when it comes down to it, they're actually being put on a hit. But they're not even really being put on a hit. They're being put out as a distraction so somebody else can pull off the hit. And I think I said earlier something about how when you have the main narrative of the story told by somebody you can't trust, you don't really know what you just saw. And, you know, I actually just watched this movie today. And yeah, I don't know how much of the story that we were told I honestly believe, you know, because it's being told by the ne'er-do-well of the story. And it's just, I think it kind of got a bad rap, and it's partly to do with the fact that, you know, I don't think Bryan Singer's career has even come close to something like that since. I also think that people kind of have like this nasty taste in their mouth right now for movies with twists in them, and that could be largely attributed to M. Night Shyamalan with, you know, knocking them out and again and again and again and again and again. But I think this is a really good movie, and I don't think the time has been very kind to it, because I think it's an excellent movie, and I do like the way that it takes that convention and it stands it on its ear. And, you know, it's not something physical that you're stealing, and it's actually something more like it's an idea. It's actually an identity that's, you know, the main focus of the heist. And I think that's interesting. So
that's an absolutely fantastic movie. And I, you know, it's one of those that you really enjoy first reactions to. And I was able to show it to my fiance just last week, and she'd never seen it before, and it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy that movie, and it's actually one that was on my list but got bumped off. But fun stuff. I really enjoy the Usual Suspects. Great film.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I was just thinking about that, and it never occurred to me before, and at least I'd never, you know, thought about it, but that movie has lost a lot of respect over the years, if you really think about it, because a lot of people are dismissive of it now. But when it came out, it was the shit. Everyone was all like, have you seen Usual Suspects? You have to go. You're never going to figure it out. It's such a great movie. And, you know, it did really well at the box office, and it did pretty well with the accolades and whatnot. And then just over the years, people kind of dismiss it as some stupid thing. And I think it was, I thought it was incredibly well written. I was actually surprised at how well I was enjoying how it was directed today, because I've never really thought of Bryan Singer as a director. I know that's what's on his resume and everything, but he did some interesting stuff with that movie visually, and I just didn't remember it. And, you know, just quick shout out, you know, it's got Pete Postlewaithe in it, the late, the great Pete, and he was in Inception. So I enjoy that movie a lot. And I,
so would that be Peter fucking Postlewaithe?
It can't be because he's dead. But you know, we don't, that's one of the rules of Ruth Oz, is you can't be inducted if you're deceased. Basically, it's a way to keep...
It's not a post-fucking-humus award.
No, it isn't a post-fucking-humus award. Basically, it's just a way that we can get... It's a way to make the number a little bit more manageable. But it was actually when we talked about his death on the show, I was quite unhappy that I had never nominated him, because I love Pete Postlewaithe. Yeah. And so
I love him. He's a fantastic actor. Mm-hmm. Entirely underrated character actor of our day, that, you know, a lot of people say, who the hell's that? And then you're like, this guy. Oh, yeah, I've seen that guy in all this other stuff.
He's in so many movies. But, yeah, I like The Usual Suspects, and it probably shouldn't be my number one, but that's just how I wrote it down, and I'm not feeling, I don't know, aggressive enough to have changed my my list mid-stride like that. So
I'm surprised to hear you talk about it as a film that has lost respect over the years, because I still think of it actually as a huge cult film, especially among, you know, film guys and guys who want to go on to be directors. And I think you're right that there is an issue in that it and The Sixth Sense sort of ushered in this unfortunate love of twist endings. But those two films did it right.
Yeah.
And, just like it's, you can't really blame Tarantino for his imitators. It seems unfair to blame, these films for badly executed films with ridiculous twist endings.
Well, I honestly think that the people that disrespect these kind of films are not people that are, you know, in our age bracket. I mean, they weren't, you know, like they'll go and see it, and they'll see it for the first time, and if they're, you know, 16 years old, it's not going to mean anything to them, because, you know, first off, I would imagine that even if you hadn't seen the movie, you've heard the catchphrase, you know, who is Kaiser Soze, and, you know, I see dead people and stuff like that. But, you know, it was something else to live it. And, you know, it was just kind of an exciting time in films. And, you know, I was really looking forward to the careers of these people. And I don't have anything negative to say about Bryan Singer, but he hasn't knocked it out of the park yet, and I think he will eventually, because he, you know, especially with this movie, I was surprised at how well he directed it. And, you know, Christopher McQuarrie does write some good stuff. And overall, I have nothing but respect for it. And I would imagine that people in their 30s and 40s would, you know, be the same way, but younger people just aren't going to get it, because they're not going to remember a time, you know, pre Usual Suspects or pre Sixth Sense or something like that. So,
sure.
Yeah, and it's just, I really enjoy it, and it's just, it's one of those, and Ethan nailed it, it's one of those movies that's an awful lot of fun to show to people if they haven't seen it, you know, because they think they're so fucking smart, because I have seen it with so many people the first time that, you know, they get about 45 minutes to an hour into the movie, and they're just dead convinced that Keaton's really Kaiser Soze, and you're just sitting back going, mwahaha, you fucking fool, because, you know, that's what they want you to think, and it's an awful lot, I think it's cool.
And you could do it again next when you do a list of unreliable narrator movies.
Yeah, it really. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we did.
It's,
go ahead.
It's one of those movies that sort of is one of the reasons I really love movies in general. Is Bryan Singer in that movie utilizes the medium as a way to tell a story, in that, you know, you have to take into account of the point of view you're seeing the movie from, because not all movies are from this this omnipresent, omnipotent point of view where you know everything that's going on and everything is at face value. It's, you have to remember that by the end of the movie, you've forgotten that this is being told to you as a story from this guy. And it sort of goes back to one of my absolute favorite movies, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
There you go.
It's a movie that, you know, you get caught up in it going, oh, this is great. And then you realize, wait, I'm being told a story from this person's point of view, so this might not be what happened. And by the time you get the realization in Usual Suspects
yeah.
at the end, and one of the reasons I love it is that whole movie could be entirely a lie.
That's ultimately what
you don't know.
And I was watching that. That was what I was thinking today. You know, when I was watching it, because you know you can't write off everything that's told in the interrogation room as a total lie because of
sure.
the fact that Kobayashi's the one that picks him up. So obviously he wasn't making that up, or at least mm-hmm. part of that up. You know, his name isn't Kobayashi because that was
yeah.
the porcelain company. But yeah, and I was also thinking how interesting would have it been if I don't know anybody besides Kobayashi had picked him up. You know, if it was Edie Finneran, or hell, if it was Keaton, or Keaton would have been a little too cheesy. But just somebody that wasn't Kobayashi, and it would have just put the entire story in doubt. And it might have actually been the smart move to make it Kobayashi, because now I'm doubting my doubt. Because you know, watching the movie, you're thinking, yeah, all this is a lie. And then when it's Kobayashi in the car, you're all like, well, it can't all be a lie. So what's true and what's not a lie? And oh God, I just gone cross-eyed. And I enjoy the movie a lot. I do find it unfortunate that it has the disrespect that it does, because it does go into a message board sometime and try to sing its praises, and people may, oh, that movie's stupid and blah blah blah, and they're just it's just infuriating to me.
But message boards are a technology where people tell you that things suck. You can't judge the reputation of a film from a message board full of
douchebags. You can also go and you can go look at Metacritic sites, and you can go and look at DVD rentals and DVD sales, and it's just not there, because you know I keep saying, but this movie was just like a force to be reckoned with when it came out, and I'm surprised.
Yeah.
It just does not have the same prestige now that it did when it came out, and I find it unfortunate.
Well, I guess it will have to be forgotten in order to be rediscovered.
Well, I hope so, and I hope it doesn't take
yeah.
a 3D remake with Justin Bieber as Kaiser Soze. That'd be horrible. But if you haven't seen this movie, absolutely check it out. It's on right now. It's on Netflix Instant View. I do notice that those come and go an awful lot, so I can't really speak towards the future. But I watched it today
yeah.
on Instant Stream, and it's also one of those DVDs or Blu-rays that you can find cheap. And it's totally worth the cost, no matter what you're paying for, because it's a good movie, and it's an awful lot of fun to show to somebody that hasn't seen it before. So, and I'm amazed that I did that all spoiler free, because I never said who Kaiser Soze really is.
I think you could probably hint at this point. You probably got it. But
I hinted the fuck out of it, but that's what the movie does, you know. So
yeah.
You know, hey. But yeah, it's certainly high on my list. I still think that I probably like Inception better, but don't
sure.
take that to mean that this is a bad movie, because it isn't. I really like it a lot. But I guess that's the point where we're going to be running down our overall list of 10-1. Why don't you start us off, Ethan?
Well, my number 10 is the 1992 film Sneakers. My number 9 is 2001's Ocean's 11. My number 8 is 2000's Snatch. My number 7 is the 2001 3,000 Miles to Graceland. Number 6 is The Great Muppet Caper, of course. Number 5 is Ronin. Number 4 is Heat. Number 3, The Sting. Number 2, Lady Killers. And number 1, Inception.
Excellent. Now, Robin, what's your list look like?
At number 10, I have Alfred Hitchcock's 1955 To Catch a Thief, which is possibly not, strictly speaking, a heist film, but creates the sense of glamour that is borrowed for film after film after film, including the Ocean's movies.
Mm-hmm.
Number 9, I have The Asphalt Jungle from 1950, directed by John Huston, which is sort of a
great movie,
noirish twin to The Killing, and could easily be swapped places with it on the list, also with Sterling Hayden. Number 8, Inception. Number 7, David Mamet's 2001 film Heist. Makes sense to have a film called Heist on a list of heist films.
Yeah, sure does.
And it's great in that its script consists almost entirely of aphorisms.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to the ones I mentioned before, Big Deal on Madonna Street, Asphalt Jungle, The Killing, Rafifi, The Ocean's Trilogy, and at number 1, Bob Le Flambeur.
Very good, very good. All right, we get to my list. My number 10 is the Michael Mann film Heat. My number 9 is the Ridley Scott film, 2003 Matchstick Men. My number 8 is the 1998 Steven Soderbergh film Out of Sight. my 1997. My 7 is the 1998 Guy Ritchie film Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. That's another one that really plays around the convention, and there's points in that movie you don't know what the hell is going on, and I thought that was kind of fun. And then we get to my actual list. The number 6 is The Lady Killers. Number 5 is Catch Me If You Can. Number 3 is Reservoir Dogs. Number 4 is 3,000 Miles to Graceland. My number 2 is Inception. And my number 1 was The Usual Suspects by Bryan Singer. But yeah, this has been an interesting a list. And I would, you know, no offense to Ethan or myself, but I would say check out every list on Robin's list, because every film he named off that I've seen was really good. So that makes me think I need to fill in the gaps and see the rest of them, because there's some great ones on there. Great ones on there. But yeah, this has been fun. Do you have anything else to say about the genre, either of you two?
I would, but I'm too busy planning to steal some jewels.
Do it.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm too busy planning to break into a jewelry store and leave some jewels there. Ha, just like Inception. But I guess that brings an end to the top 6 section, where we talked about our favorite heist films. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with our outro segment. You've joined us tonight with a discussion of the heist films as a genre as a whole. We had 3 top 6 lists, and it's something that we learned early on. We had 3 very different top 6 lists, which is always so much fun to learn about some of these new films. And like always, I think I'm going to always recommend people check out our guest list, and if they get around to it, they can check out Ethan or I's. But yeah, so I had fun doing this list. I don't know about you, Ethan.
Yeah, it was a ton of fun. If anything, it show me that I need to really beef up on my heist films.
Yeah, I think my problem is I made my list, 2 months ago, and haven't thought about it, and now I'm second-guessing it all the way through. But yeah, there's some good ones on here. Well, Robin, something that we do on every show with every one of our guests, I guess you can call it a door prize for being our guest, we give you the opportunity to pimp out any web presence that you have or any projects you might have going on and things that you would like people to check out that you're working on. Do you have anything like that going on?
Yes, indeed. Project-wise, I would point you again to the World Wound Gambit, which is my fantasy heist novel about a group of sword and sorcery thieves taking down a demonic tower that is launching a demonic invasion. There's also my new role-playing game, Ashton Stars. That's a game in which you are freelance troubleshooters in a far-flung sector of space, solving troubles in a gritty space opera setting. And my blog has just changed homes, so I'm now at robin-d-laws.blogspot.com, and you can follow all of my various webly peregrinations. I'm also on Twitter as Robin D. Laws, And you can also find me on Facebook or now the Google Plus, which is an exciting new platform full of internet-y grooviness.
I do love me some Google Plus. It's pretty cool. Well, go ahead.
It is really quite interesting, and the results that I'm getting from it in terms of outreach for my various projects are really huge, considering it's like only, what, 4 weeks old now, so I think it's a...
Well, it's been public 4 weeks or something like that, right? So, Well, cool. Do you have anything else to add, Ethan?
Only that for a short while, the voting is still open at Zone of Rethoughts, I believe, depending on when this goes up. We still have voting open for who should be inducted into the Zone of Rethoughts in this next round. We have the current nominees set at Gary Oldman, Morgan Freeman, Ian McKellen, and, of course, Sigourney Weaver. So it will be interesting to see who gets the coveted title this time around. So
damn, I don't care. You know, every one of those people is so awesome. But maybe we need to get Robin on the case. Yeah, Robin, why don't you get on the case and get us some more votes so we can get the right person to win this time. Although the right person always wins.
Just head to redphonezone.com, and on the right side of the website, there is a little poll you can take. So just vote early, vote often. There you go. And we'll see who gets it next time. I haven't even looked at the numbers. Never do. Not until we announce live on the show. So I don't even know who's been voted for, who's in the lead. I don't know any of that. So I'm interested to see who gets it.
Yeah, I don't have a clue. And I do know that next week we are going to be doing a Ruthaz show. The details have yet to be hammered out in terms of who's going to be on the show. It might just be Ethan and I, but we're trying to get the Bagnaboard boys over here to help us out. But we're going to be making things a little bit different than we normally do for our Ruthaz shows. We decided we're going to do a top six list of our favorite Ruthaz winner and or nominee. So that's going to be an awful lot of fun because there's a lot of good people on there. There's not been a person yet who's won that isn't freaking awesome. So I'm going to have such a hard time making that list, but it's going to be a blast putting together. But Robin brings up a good point. It's something that I've been horribly neglecting in the past, but we too are on Twitter. We're just at Red Phone Zone. We are on Facebook. We are on we are also on Google Plus. And we are on iTunes, and we have been for a long time. It turns out I was talking to some people that listened to the show. They didn't realize we're on iTunes. I'm like, dude, we've been on since like issue 4 or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we are on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes. And you can subscribe. And while you're there, rate and review. Check out our friends of the Bagged and Boardcast at iTunes while you're at it. But, yeah, we're all over the web, and you can also just go to redphonezone.com where you can find all of our episodes, even the ones that are not up on the iTunes at this point. But, yeah, we need to figure out some sort of fun way to distribute the ill-fated issue 58 that sucked, but, you know, give it out to people that really want it that bad. I don't feel like just throwing it up on iTunes. I want to make people work for it. But that'll be interesting to hear, because I might not even do that because I haven't listened to the show yet, but my memory of it was not fond. But we'll have to see when I actually hear it, and maybe we'll put together some kind of contest where you can send out and listen to the jettisoned episode. But I have nothing else to add unless you guys do.
No, I think I am good.
Are you good, Robin?
Thank you for having me, guys.
Well, it was certainly a pleasure to have you on, Robin. Thank you for your patience in all of our technical difficulties and cursing.
Yeah, and thank you for feng shui. It's a lot of fun.
Hell yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, until next week, I am Aaron.
And I am Ethan.
Let your geek flag fly.